Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 238. It's Monday, December 4th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get started with some good news. This from the New York Times. Biden administration to require replacing of lead pipes within 10 years. The Biden administration is proposing new restrictions that will require the removal of virtually all lead water pipes across the country in an effort to prevent another public health catastrophe like the one that came to define Flint, Michigan. The proposal last Thursday from the EPA would impose the strictest limits on lead in drinking water since federal standards were set 30 years ago. It would affect about 9 million pipes that snake throughout communities across the country. This is the strongest lead rule the nation has ever seen, Radhika Fox, EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, said in an interview. This is historic progress. Digging up and replacing lead pipes from coast to coast is no small undertaking. The EPA estimates the price at $20 to $30 billion over the course of a decade. The rule would require the nation's utilities, and most likely their ratepayers, to absorb most of that cost. But $15 billion is available from the 2021 infrastructure law to help them pay for it. Lead is a neurotoxin that can cause irreversible damage to the nervous system and the brain. It poses a particular danger to infants and children and can impair their cognitive development, cause behavioral disorders, and lead to lower IQs. From the nation's earliest days, lead was used to make pipes to carry water to homes and businesses. But when plumbing corrodes, lead can leach into drinking water. The EPA estimates that its proposal would generate between $10 and $35 billion in economic benefits each year in the form of less cognitive impairment and fewer health disorders, especially in children. So this is an example where you have to look at the costs and the benefits. So, you know, tens of billions of dollars, $20 to $30 billion to do this over a decade seems like a lot of money. But when you're talking about generating in perpetuity $10 to $35 billion in benefits, it's a great deal. Welcome to public health. The proposal would not eliminate the amount of lead permitted in drinking water. Instead, the Biden administration wants to lower the allowable amount to 10 parts per billion from the current 15 parts per billion. That's disappointing to many public health advocates who have called for a standard between 0 and 5 parts per billion. Scientists agree there is no safe level of lead in drinking water. The proposal, which would update regulations under the 1991 Safe Drinking Water Act, is the most forceful part of a multi-front push by President Biden to stop lead exposure. Mr. Biden has made it a central part of his administration's effort to address racial health disparities in the United States. Children in communities of color and in low-income urban areas are more likely to be exposed to lead from paint and aging water systems than their counterparts in areas with newer housing and infrastructure. The EPA will accept public comments for the proposal for 60 days and can still make changes to it before making it final sometime next year. So, another epic advance, hopefully, for public health. The previous realities would have strung out for decades, this replacement. So, bringing that down to 10 years is a huge advancement. Okay, next up, let's do a little more seasonal story. We're in respiratory virus season, not surprising. This from the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. COVID activity picks up pace alongside other respiratory viruses. After a stable period, COVID-19 activity is increasing again, especially in the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic regions, the CDC said in its latest update. In a weekly snapshot of respiratory illness activity, the CDC said, along with rises in most COVID indicators, the U.S. is experiencing elevated RSV activity and rising hospitalization for that virus, especially in young children. The flu season is also picking up steam. COVID markers rising. For COVID, hospitalizations, one of the main severity indicators, continue to rise, and early indicators also rose last week, with test positivity at 10% and emergency department visits up 11% compared with the previous week. Wastewater SARS-CoV-2 detections, another early marker, are at high levels nationally, according to the CDC's new dashboard, especially in the Midwest, and especially in Ohio, where higher than the Midwest, which is substantially higher than the U.S. as a whole. So watch out, Ohioans. Take care of yourself and take precautions. Okay, next up from CNN, suicide deaths reached a record high in the U.S. in 2022, despite hopeful decreases among children and young adults. After 2 years of decline, the suicide rate spiked in 2021 and rose to a record high in 2022, according to provisional data from the CDC. More people died from suicide in the U.S. last year than any other year on record, dating to at least 1941, according to that data. At least 49,449 lives were lost due to intentional self-harm in 2022, more than 14 deaths for every 100,000 people. Men were about four times more likely than women to die by suicide, and rates were highest among senior men. But the suicide rate increased twice as much for women in 2022, with especially significant increases among white women and those aged 25 to 34. Suicide rates have been rising in the U.S. for the past few decades. In 2021, the U.S. Surgeon General called for the implementation of a national prevention strategy and issued an advisory focused on protecting youth mental health amid a spike in suicide rates and alarming increases in mental health challenges among young people. Despite the overall increase, provisional data from 2022 shows signs of improvement in rates among children and teens. The suicide rate for children ages 10 to 14 dropped 18% to about 2 deaths for every 100,000 children, and the rates among those aged 15 to 24 fell 9% to about 14 deaths for every 100,000 people. And I'll note, if you recall, the average was 14 per 100,000 for the whole country. So the 15 to 24 category is basically the average rate for the country, and the 10 to 14 is a rate of 2, which hopefully is a lot lower for that young of an age group, definitely. Suicide rates in the U.S. are highest among elderly men, and most involve guns, a CDC report says. Teen boys and young men have had more significant improvement in suicide rates than young females did. But the vast majority of suicide deaths among teens and young adults aged 15 to 24 were still among males. Rates for all other age groups increased. Overall, age-adjusted rates remained highest among American Indian people, with about 27 suicide deaths for every 100,000 people, about double the national rate. Rates among white people were also higher than average at about 18 deaths for every 100,000 people. More than half of suicides involve firearms, and a separate analysis of provisional data by the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions found that gun suicides reached a record high in 2022. Gun suicides continue to take the lives of elderly white men at high rates and increasingly the lives of black teens, said Ari Davis, policy advisor for the center. If we can put time and space between this lethal method and someone in crisis, it can save lives. Yep, gun access is a main driver of suicides. And to get at the large costs of mental illnesses, this from Iowa Public Radio. How much is the economic loss of untreated mental illness? One state did the math, and it wasn't Iowa, it was Indiana. Mental illnesses, such as depression, can be a precursor to physical ailments that can lead to an increased risk of chronic conditions. That includes diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, according to the CDC. Untreated mental illness can also consign individuals and families to unstable lives. It's a factor for many people who experience homelessness or interact with the criminal justice system. But research shows that it also leads to a significant financial burden. Nationwide, untreated mental illness costs the United States nearly $193 billion in lost earnings every year, according to a 2008 study. Newly published research in Indiana shows the state lost $4.2 billion in 2019 due to untreated mental illness, according to the JAMA Network study. For context, corn, Indiana's leading commodity, generated $3.8 billion in sales the year before. So this is a fascinating contrast that the state lost more due to untreated mental illness than the gross sales of corn, its largest commodity. Yikes. Indiana lawmakers recently adopted a new law to improve access to mental health care. Still, those efforts are not nearly enough to help hundreds of thousands of people navigate a complex system and find treatment. The financial loss due to untreated mental illness equates to more than $600 per Indiana resident. That number was derived by looking at how many people died prematurely and didn't contribute to the economy, lost wages, and productivity if someone misses a day of work due to their mental health, and the overworked criminal justice system, and homelessness resources that have to spend additional funds on mental health services. If you take those costs that we're incurring, $4.2 billion a year, that equates to about 100,000 jobs. Good job, Indiana, taking a look at the large cost of mental illness in this country. Okay, next up, let's look at a story on air pollution, particularly for driving down the highway. This is from Medical Express. Breathing highway air increases blood pressure, research finds. For more than a century, American cities have been sliced and diced by high traffic roadways. Interstate highways and wide arterials are now a defining feature of most metropolitan areas. Their constant flow of cars spewing pollution into nearby neighborhoods. Researchers have only just begun to understand the health risks posed by all that pollution. Long-term exposure to traffic-related air pollution, a complex mixture of exhaust from tailpipes, brake and tire wear, and road dust, has been linked to increased rates of cardiovascular disease, asthma, lung cancer, and death. New research from the University of Washington suggests these health risks are also seen in people traveling busy roads. A study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine found that unfiltered air from rush hour traffic significantly increased passengers' blood pressure, both while in the car and up to 24 hours later. Breathing unfiltered air resulted in a net blood pressure increase of more than 4.5 millimeters of mercury when compared to drives with filtered air. Of course, air is not normally filtered. They just filtered it to get a comparison of actually clean air. The increase occurred rapidly, peaking about an hour into the drive and holding steady for at least 24 hours. Researchers did not test past the 24-hour mark. The size of the increase is comparable to the effect of a high-sodium diet. So if you're doing a long commute on the highway particularly, yikes, your blood pressure increase could be comparable to a high-sodium diet. Whoa. We know that modest increases in blood pressure like this on a population level are associated with significant increase in cardiovascular disease. There's a growing understanding that air pollution contributes to heart problems. The idea that roadway air pollution at relatively low levels can affect blood pressure this much is an important piece of the puzzle we're trying to solve. Traffic-related air pollution is the main cause of air quality variation from community to community in most U.S. metropolitan areas. This study is exciting because it takes a gold standard design for laboratory studies and applies it to an on-roadway setting, answering an important question about the health effects of real-world exposures. Studies on this topic often have a challenging time separating the effects of pollution from other roadway exposures like stress and noise. But with this approach, the only difference between drive days was air pollution concentration. The findings are valuable because they can reproduce situations that millions of people actually experience every day. Okay, well, let's move on to an even larger source of air pollution. That would be smoking. This is from Medical Express. Decline in excess mortality seen in first decade after quitting smoking. Yes, it is a good idea to quit. Former smokers avoid more than half of the excess cardiovascular, cancer, and respiratory mortality associated with current smoking within the first decade after quitting, according to a research letter published in JAMA Internal Medicine. Little or no excess cardiovascular mortality was seen at 20 to 29 years after quitting among former smokers. Former smokers avoided an estimated 100%, 93%, and 97% of the excess cardiovascular, cancer, and respiratory mortality associated with continued smoking after 30 or more years of smoking cessation. These findings emphasize that with sustained cessation, cause-specific mortality rates among former smokers may eventually approximate those of never smokers. And actually, one of the big things of just carbon monoxide that you're getting, which is pretty toxic to your cardiovascular system, that basically disappears within 24 hours after quitting. So there are large immediate benefits, and the risk gets less and less as time goes on. So if you're interested in quitting smoking, you can call the Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW for resources and assistance. Okay, well, the public health battle against tobacco seems to be a never-ending one. And here's this next story from the Yale School of Public Health is another good example of that. Chemical additives replace menthol in new non-menthol cigarettes. Some non-menthol cigarettes that are marked as a fresh alternative in states where traditional menthol cigarettes are banned use synthetic chemicals to mimic menthol's distinct cooling sensations, research at Yale and Duke University have found. The synthetic additives could undermine existing policies at the U.S. FDA and their ban on menthol cigarettes that's expected later this year that is intended to discourage new smokers and address the harmful health effects of tobacco use. In a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers identified a synthetic flavoring agent known as WS3 in the newly introduced non-menthol cigarettes that delivers similar or even stronger cooling sensations as menthol, but without the minty aroma or taste. Flavored tobacco products such as menthol cigarettes tend to reduce tobacco's harsh effects, making it particularly popular among young people and those just starting to smoke. Historically, menthol cigarettes have also been aggressively marketed towards African Americans, with up to 90% of African Americans who smoke using menthol cigarettes. Sustained tobacco use can cause nicotine addiction, severe respiratory problems, cancer, numerous other adverse health conditions, and death. When California's menthol ban was enacted in December 2022, the big tobacco companies introduced non-menthol cigarette brands as menthol substitutes with very similar packaging and marketing strategies as their menthol counterparts. These findings are concerning, and the U.S. FDA should develop strategies on how to address odorless cooling agents that could bypass tobacco product flavor regulations. Other countries that have in fact begun to address this, for example, Canada has a detailed list of specific ingredients that are allowed, and Belgium has restrictions on any cooling activity in tobacco products. So that's a wonderful way that Canada does it. Rather than just banning certain things, you actually come up with a few things that are allowed to allow tobacco smoking to still happen, but get rid of these things that really push people for starting smoking. And of course, there's a racial ethnic disparity because it's pushed so much among Black folks. Okay, well, next up, we got a story that's a very good example of how the long shadow of big tobacco echoes on in public health today. This from Stat News. Big weed today is a whole lot like big tobacco in the 1950s. Okay, marijuana is now legal. That is mostly legal in most states. So where's the public health approach? For years, health experts have argued that criminalizing marijuana use was a mistake, and that rather than handling the drug as a law enforcement problem with cops, lawyers, and jails, we should manage it as a public health problem with prevention, treatment, and harm reduction. I have served as a health commissioner for both New York City and Philadelphia, and at one time I had hopes of moving to a public health approach to illegal drugs. But instead, to my horror, the legalization freight train rolling across the nation is replacing law enforcement with corporate marketing, reminiscent of the tactics of big tobacco in the 20th century. It's time for us to respond to marijuana now, as we belatedly responded to tobacco. Doctors' opinions about marijuana vary. Some believe it's valuable for people suffering from chronic pain, like that from cancer. Many others, including me, worry a lot about its risk of addiction, strong link to schizophrenia, intoxicated driver car crashes, and harms not yet proven. Remember, the lag between starting smoking cigarettes and lung cancer is about 25 years. But I hope we can all agree on at least this. As a society, we should not be actively encouraging people to use this drug. Yet, encouraging recreational marijuana use is exactly what is happening. In the first half of the 20th century, the tobacco industry's clever, ubiquitous marketing of an addictive drug transformed smoking from a niche hobby into a daily habit for nearly half of American adults. Today's cannabis industry is using the same manipulative methods, and then some. The tobacco companies, for all of their marketing savvy, offered just a few products to deliver nicotine: cigarettes, cigars, loose tobacco, pipe tobacco, and chewing tobacco. But today's marijuana stores are pushing a jaw-dropping array of products to deliver THC well beyond leaf and vape oils. There are THC tablets, tinctures, dried concentrate, gummies, mints, lollipops, fizzy drinks, salves, patches, lip balms, massage oils, personal lubricants, and even bath bombs. Retailers sell these products in cheery, brightly colored packages that are attractive to kids. A century ago, Big Tobacco calmed people's fears with outrageous claims that smoking was actually good for you. Camel promotes good digestion and gives you healthy nerves, it touted. A famous New York research laboratory, R.J. Reynolds, told Americans in 1934 had, quote, confirmed that Camel has a positive, energizing effect, a healthful and delightful release of natural, vibrant energy. Today, cannabis companies grease sales with their own health claims, among them that marijuana helps you lose weight, prevent diabetes, and protects your brain. The tobacco companies advertise in the media channels of the day, newspapers, magazines, radio, and from its very early days, television. They use scores of what we would call today influencers. Lucille Ball and her husband Desi Arnaz were there to tell you that you'll be glad tomorrow that you smoked Philip Morris today. Desi probably wasn't glad when he died of lung cancer in 1986. Today's marijuana corporations are advertising on radio, billboards, and digital channels. The industry's influencers, from Wiz Khalifa and Seth Rogen, count followers in the millions and are as likely to own their own brands as to be owned by them. In the 1990s, Americans were scandalized by the news that for decades Philip Morris had secretly manipulated freebase nicotine levels in Marlboro to hook more smokers. Today's marijuana manufacturers aren't bothering with secrecy. They are in a public arms race to raise THC levels in their products to make them more addictive. 50 years ago, weed sold on the street had a THC concentration of about 2%. Now, retailers routinely offer buds with THC levels more than 10 times that, alongside concentrates that are nearly 80% THC. All this marketing, of course, is about getting new customers. As one expert admits, and sure enough, this marketing has a lot. The number of Americans who use marijuana daily or almost daily nearly quadrupled from 2002 to 2021 to 17.4 million users from 4.7 million. The states that legalized early, like Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, are seeing the highest marijuana use, with roughly a third of 18 to 25-year-olds now using the drug at least once a month. Those states have seen increases not only in legal marijuana use, but also illegal marijuana use and marijuana addiction. Marijuana marketing originates from increasingly large and increasingly multinational corporations. Wall Street itself is becoming hooked on marijuana. Global marijuana markets are growing like a weed, an investment website reads. It's no wonder that many investors are interested in owning cannabis stocks. It is reminiscent of something Warren Buffett is quoted as saying in the 1989 book, Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco. I'll tell you why I like the cigarette business. It costs a penny to make. Sell it for a dollar. It's addictive. The global cannabis market is now estimated to be more than $50 billion per year. 24 cannabis companies have market capitalizations of more than $100 million, of which five are worth more than $1 billion. Curaleaf boasts that it operates more than 150 dispensaries in 18 states and has 21 cultivation sites. Tilray sells THC products under more than 10 different brand names and has operations on five continents. To the Federal Food and Drug Administration and Drug Enforcement Administration, marijuana is still illegal, so we have to look at states to rein in this marketing. And so far, state governments have done little to prevent the harms of legal marijuana use. The model they tend to use is one for alcohol: issue licenses, grab the tax dollars, but otherwise let the industry do what it wants. Alcohol is the wrong model. To find a better model, we don't have to look far. It's tobacco. Since World War II, alcohol use has been roughly level in this country, but thanks to public health approaches, smoking has fallen by about 75%. A true public health approach to legal marijuana based on the tobacco model would first regulate the product to reduce its risk, putting safer limits on potency and prohibiting new THC delivery forms until they were evaluated for safety. That includes prohibiting, for example, gummies, lollipops, sodas, and other THC-containing edibles that are so attractive to toddlers. It would, as with packs of cigarettes, regulate the packaging. That would include requiring childproof containers. While some states have requirements on the books, there is little enforcement, and accidental poisonings are skyrocketing. Limiting the total THC amount in a package, requiring generic text and prohibiting graphics, and including traffic light style labeling of THC content. It would put strict limits on the number, density, and location of retail operations and prohibit home delivery that can be used by teens. That could include state control of retail sales, as some other countries in the U.S. states do with liquor. It would prohibit advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. Do you really want the local weed store sponsoring your kid's soccer team? And ban any unproven health claims. The FDA has occasionally warned companies about unproven health claims related to CBD and Delta-8 THC, but states need to crack down much more than they are now. It would tax the product heavily enough to discourage use and base the tax on THC content to counterbalance the drive to higher potency products. And it would use some of those tax revenues to fund not just treatment for marijuana addiction, but also strong anti-marijuana education campaigns like those the CDC anti-smoking ads that are effective in prompting smokers to quit. Locking people up for selling or possessing small amounts of marijuana never worked. Now that our nation is revising its approach to this drug, we have an opportunity to do better. But we can prevent the damage from marijuana only if we set firm limits now on a ravenous industry that cares only about profits. Once again, the root cause is unfettered capitalism.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I led off this week's episode about getting lead out of water pipes, but we've already done a good effort of getting lead out of the air, which was getting rid of leaded gasolines. And here's a story that gets at how much that's benefited us till this very day. This from Medical Express. U.S. Clean Air Act associated with increased average lifetime earnings of $21,400. Early exposure to airborne lead has long-term outcomes on unemployment, disability, and lifetime earnings. And the passage of the U.S. Clean Air Act in 1970 has had an estimated U.S. $4.23 trillion in benefits through its impacts on airborne lead levels and the resulting increase in labor market outcomes, according to a new study published in the Open Access Journal PLOS ONE. The study found that the decrease in air lead between 1975 and 1985, resulting from the passage of the Clean Air Act, is associated with an increase in lifetime earnings of 3.5%, or $21,400 for the average U.S. worker, with greater impacts on women than men. Additionally, greater exposure to air lead in utero was associated with increase in adult disability, an increase in receiving public assistance, and a decrease in employment. Overall, the total earnings impact of the Clean Air Act totals $4.23 trillion, with a benefit of about $252 billion in 2020 alone. The authors conclude that there are long-term links among lead air exposure, cognitive development, and socioeconomic outcomes. The Clean Air Act's lead phase-out is still returning a national dividend of more than 1% each year, they report. The authors add, these results indicate the phase-out of leaded gasoline in the 1970s and 80s is continuing to pay long-term dividends. They also highlight the importance of continued efforts to identify and abate lead in drinking water and old paint. So what a great public health success story that we're getting a 1% return on that. In perpetuity, as long as we don't have lead in the air, we're getting that benefit from the state that existed prior to the Clean Air Act. Thank you, public health. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's drill down to a more specific form of indoor air pollution. This from the Washington Post. Using hot hair tools may boost unhealthy emissions, study says. Researchers studied indoor air emissions from hair straightening products and tools. Heat made emissions worse. The products that produce shiny, frizz-free hair emit high levels of substances that could endanger human health, research published concludes, and heated styling tools may make the problem worse. Published in Environmental Science and Technology, the analysis focused on compounds known as siloxanes. These substances smooth, straighten, and add shine to the hair and are ubiquitous in hair care products, the authors write. Despite their abundance, the researchers warn siloxanes haven't been adequately studied in humans. Animal studies suggest siloxanes can accumulate in the body and cause liver, lung, and nervous system damage, but it isn't clear how they affect humans, especially during hair care routines that typically take place in tight spaces and involve heated styling tools. Hair care routines involving heat produce more volatile organic compound emissions, with hair straightening pushing emissions higher than any other styling method. This is likely due to the prolonged contact of the straightener and the saturated hair and freshly applied products, the researchers surmise. Emissions generated during heated hair care were substantially higher than those measured in previous studies that looked at other personal care products like shampoos that are designed to be washed away. Though having the bathroom fan on during the hair care routine helped significantly reduce exposure, they say, the doses of siloxane exposure were still high. Studies of the long-term impact of siloxane exposures on human health are urgently needed, they conclude. The products may also affect the atmosphere in urban areas, they write, contributing up to 6 tons of such emissions to the atmosphere every year in the United States. And of course, that's looking just at one, focusing on one compound. There are many volatile organic compounds that are health issues in humans. Okay, well, let's switch to a little bit of good news. This is from Axios. More Americans could get dental coverage under Biden proposal. Dental care could soon become more widely available to adults who buy health insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplaces under a new federal proposal that aims to narrow a longstanding coverage gap in the 2010 health care law. Healthy teeth and gums are tied to a person's overall health. For instance, gum disease is linked to cardiovascular issues and diabetes, but dental services are often treated differently than medical care. The Biden administration proposal may especially benefit people of color and those with lower incomes, who are more likely to have poor oral health. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services last week proposed allowing states to include adult dental services as a, quote, essential health benefit that ACA health plans must cover without imposing annual or lifetime limits on customers. While states wouldn't have to require the coverage, the proposal would reverse a ban on states from including adult dental services as an essential benefit. However, insurers are already required to offer the benefit for kids covered through the ACA marketplaces. It's not clear how many states would add the coverage as an essential benefit. They'll have to consider how it would affect insurance costs. If the proposal was finalized, states could add the benefits starting in 2025. Dental coverage can be out of reach for adults with other types of government coverage. States do not have to cover adult dental benefits in Medicaid, and more than half provide limited or no coverage through their programs. Traditional Medicare also doesn't cover dental benefits, though enrollees can get oral health coverage through private Medicare Advantage plans. But earlier this month, the Biden administration expanded all Medicare beneficiaries' access to dental services when they're necessary for other medical care, like cancer treatment. Improving coverage and access to oral health care is part of a strategic plan the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services laid out last year. Next up, a story for aging U.S. citizens, which gets a little bit at the adage of, despite the cost of living, it's still quite popular. From Axios, aging America faces a senior care crisis. As America's population of seniors grows, affordable long-term care is increasingly hard to find. Nearly 70% of older adults will need some kind of long-term care services, according to Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Medicare doesn't cover these services, and Medicaid often has long wait lists for at-home support. The cost of daily assistance at home is out of reach for most, and so is assisted living, which bundles housing and care together. So here it is. How many Americans can afford such care? 13% of adults 75 plus in U.S. metro areas living alone can afford assisted living without diving into assets. Of course, that's 87% who can't. And 14% can afford a daily visit from a home health care aide along with their housing costs, which of course means that 86% can. For context, more than 40% of Americans 65 and older live alone. When considering seniors over 80, that share jumps to nearly 60%. Long-term care, just another gaping hole in the American healthcare system.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, I want to end the regular reporting of this episode with a story that goes big, both by going for climate change and honing in on the real problem, which is the world's richest 1%. This is from phys.org. The world's richest 1% emit as much carbon as the bottom two-thirds, says report. The richest 1% of the global population are responsible for the same amount of carbon emissions as the world's poorest two-thirds, or 5 billion people, according to an analysis published by the nonprofit Oxfam International. While fighting the climate crisis is a shared challenge, not everyone is equally responsible, and government policies must be tailored accordingly, Max Lawson, who co-authored the report, said. The richer you are, the easier it is to cut both your personal and your investment emissions, he said. You don't need that third car or that fourth holiday, and you don't need to be invested in the cement industry. Among the key findings of this study are that the richest 1% globally, that's 77 million people, were responsible for 16% of global emissions related to their consumption. That is the same share as the bottom 66% of the global population by income, or 5.1 billion people. The income threshold for being among the global top 1% was adjusted by country using purchasing power parity. For example, in the United States, the threshold for the 1% income would be $140,000, whereas the Kenyan equivalent would be about $40,000. The key message, according to Lawson, was that policy actions must be progressive. Those measures could include, for example, a tax on flying more than 10 times a year, or a tax on non-green investments that is much higher than the tax on green investments. While the current report focused on carbon linked only to individual consumption, the personal consumption of the super rich is dwarfed by emissions resulting from their investments in companies, the report found. Nor are the wealthy invested in polluting industries at a similar ratio to any given investor. Billionaires are twice as likely to be invested in polluting industries than the average for the Standard & Poor 500, previous Oxfam research has shown. Of course, if you want to get rich and stay rich, you have to destroy the planet while you're doing it. Perhaps we can do something different. But either way, this is a message to the 99% that maybe we need to focus on limits to the 1%. Tax the rich. tax those destroying the planet. Okay, well, that brings us to our next regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 35 articles this week. So let's get rolling. Bonus article 1. Doctors warned of New Zealand health tragedy after smoking ban scrapped. So New Zealand had some of the most progressive public health laws around smoking, and the new conservative government trashed a lot of that. It's a good example, as I reported in this episode earlier in the regular reporting, that it's a constant fight in public health, as in much of politics, is you make some progress and somebody wants to trash it. So there you go. Number one leading cause of preventable cause of death in the world, smoking. We definitely need to do stuff about that. Bonus article 2. Disease could be a bigger killer than bombs in Gaza, warns WHO. Of course, this is true with basically all war. The death tallies are usually by counting bodies that are killed by bullets and bombs and fire and the like from so-called active war. But the more so-called passive collateral damage that happens in the long term is probably going to be infectious disease and potentially starvation in Gaza, an example of war as being a public health crisis. Bonus article 3, also getting at why forcing solutions often doesn't work in prevention and treatment. Psychiatry, violence, and the state. California's systematic failure of its unhoused population. So there's been a lot of news this last year about California and New York City trying to force people into mental health treatment, which has been a long tradition in this country. But research shows that's not a helpful way, and it's a very expensive way of dealing with such problems. Bonus article 4, how to break the cycle of childhood trauma? Help a baby's parents. It's just another example of how you need to deal with the larger system rather than just the individual. And if you have childhood trauma, helping the whole family, the parents, helps a lot. Bonus article 5. Many owners see little value in storing their firearms safely, finds study. So this is similar to what I've reported on before, that access to guns that are present in a home is a big factor in both suicides and homicides. Next up, another interesting gun story, bonus article 6, a lead ammo compromise, incentives edge out ban. So as I reported before, actually lead pollution from lead ammunition is a big issue. It's actually very much concentrated in a lot of wildlife populations, like birds that'll eat carcasses that are left over that have a lot of lead pollution. You can have half of the birds in a population that have lead poisoning. But it's a larger problem of just lead poisoning in the environment as a whole. And the thing is, you can get copper ammunition. It costs about 25% more, but of course people are going to use what's cheap. And the lead, unfortunately, explodes out into many small pieces and fragments, which makes the pollution problem worse, where copper doesn't do that. Of course, copper is not the same kind of poison. And the incentives edge out bans issue is that kind of characteristic of our country's approach is we don't go out and just say, this is dangerous, let's stop that, we'll just use copper ammunition, for instance. But there are incentives in some places where it'll actually cover most of the cost of your ammunition if you get copper ammunition, so it's one route to go. Okay, another pollution story, a lead story. Bonus article 7, new research supports potential link between low-level lead exposure and liver injury. And of course, this is a big problem. We've seen a lot of more lead exposure and more liver injury in African-American populations, and this may be some explanation of that link. Bonus article 8, UN human rights experts express alarm over PFAS pollution in North Carolina. So this is pretty bad. When you get corporate malfeasance that's so widespread and it affects profoundly so much of the population that is considered a human rights violation. I don't know what more to say about that. Bonus Article 9. A new law regulating the cosmetics industry expands the FDA's power, but fails to ban toxic chemicals in beauty products. Again, curtail a bit, but if we know something to be toxic, maybe we should get something closer to a ban. Bonus Article 10. Why we're still breathing dirty indoor air. So I report on a lot of this is one of the biggest public health challenges of our generation. It's akin to getting indoor sanitation for water and clean outdoor air through the Clean Air Act and such. So that's a good overview article. Bonus Article 11, how to overcome the biggest obstacle to abortion care in blue states, so-called pregnancy crisis centers. So anti-abortion has set up these so-called pregnancy crisis centers and direct people away from abortion services and can be very misleading to people. Bonus Article 12, Poland's radical anti-abortion law didn't have the intended pronatal effect. So actually, women in Poland have pretty much decided that having a baby is maybe not something they want to do. And the radical anti-abortion law is a big part of that. But of course, there's other social things as far. But if anti-abortionists want to create a so-called pro-life, pronatal culture, they need to treat women better. End of story. Bonus Article 13. Nobody cared. Women who have reported mistreatment while giving birth say CDC report validates their trauma. So this is a study of the CDC that basically documents the fact that many women giving birth have been subject to abuse and mistreatment. Not a good time when women are that vulnerable. Bonus Article 14. Vaccine disparities are worst post-emergency as efforts wither. So this is really a lesson that if you put resources and efforts and attention into something, you can actually make a difference and minimize or reduce disparities. But what we're seeing now is after the post-emergency of the coronavirus pandemic, we're seeing that the disparities are actually worsening and worse than they were at the beginning of the pandemic. Bonus Article 15, the 10 chilling laws of pandemics. A good read if you want to understand the dynamics of dealing with pandemics in the future, which is a certainty, a probability that will hit most of us again in our lifetimes. Bonus Article 16, we're living the reality of the pandemic's simplest math. Sick season will be worse from now on. And basically, by adding COVID to the whole slew of respiratory viruses and such, it's only going to be worse. And of course, COVID, even now, is the driver for the most hospitalizations and deaths of respiratory illnesses, infectious respiratory illnesses. Bonus Article 17, Medicaid unwinding makes other public assistance harder to get. So often it's the same staff who are trying to deal with this overwhelming Medicaid unwinding that also have to try to get link people up with other public assistance, and that's kind of crashing the system. Bonus Article 18, Medicare Advantage increasingly popular with seniors, but not hospitals and doctors. So we're seeing two things, an increasing number of seniors who are getting locked into these Medicare Advantage plans, but hospitals and doctors are actually increasingly starting to opt out of these plans. Because of so many problems, don't even want to get into that. I've covered that a lot before, but Medicare Advantage has a lot of problems. Bonus Article 19, Federal Trade Commission chief gears up for a showdown with private equity. So this is where private equity in healthcare is actually causing so many market problems that the FTC feels a need to get involved. Bonus Article 20, why doctors and pharmacists are in revolt. Once accustomed to a status outside the usual management labor hierarchy, many health professionals now feel as put upon as any clock-punching worker. 21. Makers of Wegovy and Ozempic shower money on U.S. obesity doctors, concentrating that money on an elite group of obesity specialists who advocate giving its powerful and expensive drugs to tens of millions of Americans. Bonus Article 22. The U.S. pharmacy industry is crumbling. Here's how to fix it. Another good overview of the decline of pharmacies and pharmacy deserts and just workplace professional issues, workforce issues that are a problem. Bonus Article 23. Scientists in discredited alcohol study will not advise U.S. on drinking guidelines. So these guys got bumped off. They stopped this. They had to cancel a huge NIH study because they had solicited $30 million from alcohol beverage companies. When that was found out, it just totally kiboshed the whole approach. And those folks were about ready to be on this advisory, federal advisory committee, but they got booted. Bonus article 24. The next census could undercount the number of disabled Americans by 20 million. That would be an undercount by about half under the current way that disability is measured under the census. So that's a problem because it's the undercounting, but it's also a problem just from a data point of view. When you change the way that you're measuring it, you end up creating apples and oranges comparisons, which is difficult to do. So it's hard to judge trends and such. But measuring less disability, disabling conditions and such in Americans is not necessarily a good move. Bonus article 25, invisible in the data. Broad Asian American category obscures health disparities. So this is also when you collapse all Asian American folks into one category, it really obscures all the different cultural differences and practices in health that would lead to different health disparities and a potential solution to them. Now get to a couple. Nutrition stories. Bonus article 26. Keto diet promotes greater lean muscle loss. So those, if any of you out there are, or you know somebody who's inclined to be a big fan of the keto diet, it actually can, you can produce weight loss similarly as any other diet. Part of the problem though is because you're getting so few carbohydrates, which your body needs, you end up cannibalizing your muscle mass, your lean mass, and you actually lose more lean muscle mass than other types of diets, different type of metabolism going on there. So if you're measuring just the total weight, it's not a good representation necessarily of the fat that you're losing. Bonus article 27, vitamin D supplements do not prevent bone fractures in children, find study. So this is perhaps a little bit surprising, but it's a good example of where a single reductive approach to nutrition or many other health or science problems doesn't really work. For instance, these were in kids that were shown to be vitamin D deficient, and it did increase their vitamin D levels in their blood, but it didn't affect bone fractures. That doesn't necessarily mean that vitamin D is not helpful for the development of bones. What it means is that healthy bones has more to do than vitamin D, and if you're not getting enough calcium or magnesium or other type of things, you might actually find that the vitamin D is maybe a necessary but not sufficient factor in bone development. 28, we're processivores, how to rebuild our eating habits. So this is about ultra-processed foods, that most of our diet, almost two-thirds of our diet, is ultra-processed foods. How can we move away from that? Good article, very provocative. Need a big change in that one. Bonus article 29, study shows price discounts on healthful foods leads to increase in consumption. So while that may not be surprising, it leads to an opportunity that if we were to subsidize, say, fruits and vegetables rather than grains that end up being just refined or being fed to animals or used to fuel our cars, that we might actually have greater health at less cost. Bonus article 30, tackling climate change and alleviating hunger. States recycle and donate food headed to the landfill. So these are kind of gleaning programs which reduce waste and can actually improve human nutrition. A double win. Bonus article 31, can agriculture kick its plastic addiction? Agriculture uses about 3% of the plastics in the U.S., and the question is, though, more from a health perspective, is that that plastic is tightly weaved within our food supply. So when you talk about microplastic and chemical pollution from plastics in our food, that can be a problem. Bonus article 32, recycled plastics contain more chemicals than original plastics. So plastics kind of absorb a lot of other chemicals. So when they're out and about, they absorb these chemicals and they get made into recycled plastics. There's actually more chemicals in them. Bonus Article 33, How to End Plastic Pollution on Earth for Good. There's a big read and fresh perspective. Bonus Article 34, Too Much Stuff. Can we solve our addiction to consumerism? Even there, getting to a more basic underlying problem is that even if we move to so-called green economies, consumerism is a massive strain on the Earth's resources and ecology. Lastly, but not least, bonus article 35, America is getting lonelier and more indoorsy. That's not a coincidence. Our relationship to nature and our relationships with one another are deeply intertwined. And I would argue is one of the even more basic things that needs to be addressed if we're going to have a sustainable planet and a healthy planet and a healthy planet of all those who reside, plant, animal, and human. You can read these and all the other stories I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.